to the Evolution Eats podcast. I'm Noah.
And I'm Emily. And today we have Jack Bobo.
Jack's expertise is in agricultural, biotechnology, global food policy, and consumer behavior. He spent many years working at the U.S. Department of State in leadership roles in biotechnology and global food policy. He also spent a significant amount of time working as a chief communications officer at a major biotech company that works on ag biotech and synthetic biology. Jack also has a law degree and a master's in environmental science. He also spent time in the Peace Corps after college. Recently, Jack has been giving talks all over the world and is an expert in how agricultural biotechnology and consumer trends and behaviors will shape the future of food. Recently, he started his own consulting firm called Futurity.
So, Jack, tell us just a little bit about your background, because I think you have a real wealth of knowledge. What is your, like, core mission with Futurity?
Great, thanks, and thanks for having me on the program.
Oh, of course.
Well, I started at the State Department, where I was in the Office of Food Policy, and I was at the State Department for 13 years. I spent a few years working on Africa, food policy, food technology, food security issues. Then I worked in Asia for a few years, then Europe, then I ran our global biotechnology program. And then my last few years at the State Department, I had perhaps the best job in the U.S. government. My only job was giving speeches. So I had an unlimited travel budget. I could travel anywhere in the world and just talk about the future of food, the role of science, and how do we better communicate with the public. So it gave me an opportunity to travel to maybe 50 or 60 countries to see what was happening in those places and to talk about what was happening in other areas. From there, I went to a company called Intrexon, and it's a parent company for the Arctic apples, which are the non-browning GMO apples, aqua bounty salmon, animal cloning, the genetically engineered mosquitoes fighting Zika, so all sorts of interesting things. I was head of communication and government affairs there for about 3.5 years. And for the last year, I started my own consulting firm, Futurity. And I like to say that it's where food meets future. And it's an interesting time in the food world. And so what I tell people, my personal mission is to try to figure out a way to de-escalate this tension in our food system so that we can all get about our business of saving the planet in our own way.
Wow, yeah, that's a great mission. I think we're definitely on board with that, for sure. Yeah, part of our mission here is to talk to people with different backgrounds and different points of view on sort of these major food issues, because they can become, you know, these huge debates and very personal, and then you really can't get anything done.
Yeah, it's hard to make progress, but in some ways I feel like it's even more insidious than that, because it undermines confidence, not just in the companies or the products that people are sometimes going after, but it undermines consumer confidence in our entire food system. So we actually all suffer because of that.
Yeah, I would agree.
I'm curious a bit what you mean by consumer confidence. I think it's a bit challenging for the person going about their ordinary life to sort of think about consumer behavior and how their own choices are a reflection of what a consumer might want or need or think of a certain company or idea.
Yeah, so I think about it like this, that we have the safest, most abundant food supply in the history of humanity, and people have never been more scared of the food they eat. You know, people are worried about food additives, they're worried about preservatives, they're worried about colorings, they're worried about all sorts of things. And in many ways, that's a result of the incredible safety of our food. You know, 100 years ago, people were worried about dying when they ate adulterated foods. You know, now they're wondering, you know, will I somehow, you know, get cancer 50 years from now from eating this particular preservative? And so our conception of what, you know, safe food is has changed over time.
Well, I certainly wouldn't debate that there are people who have those fears, and that I think the smarter among us certainly represent a group that has come to show some odd disdain for what is arguably absolutely the healthiest, wealthiest, best time to be alive and eating food in the history of the planet. So let's certainly agree on that starter point. I would actually counter that the average person has no conception of what's in their food and isn't afraid at all because they're not even thinking about it.
Well, yeah, so I guess I'm thinking about people who are creating food trends and driving food trends. So if you look at the rise of clean eating, you know, clean eating in many ways is nothing more than, you know, people being afraid that something that they eat might unintentionally harm them, as opposed to, you know, just eating the, you know, 5 servings of fruits and vegetables that we all know that we should do, and yet 90% of us don't do. You know, people are looking for some superfood fix when, you know, there's really a simple solution. If you get the right number of servings, you don't need superfoods. And if you eat superfoods, they still don't replace those 5 servings.
Yeah, I think this is a fascinating conversation.
Let me just give one concrete example. So every year, the Environmental Working Group comes out with the Dirty Dozen, which is the list of the dozen fruits and vegetables with the largest number of pesticide residues on them. And of course they're doing this because, you know, they would like to draw attention to pesticide residues and reduce those. But what we also know is that many consumers, and particularly low-income consumers who hear about that, when they go to the grocery store, what they end up doing is buying less or fewer fruits and vegetables generally, because they don't remember which ones they're supposed to be avoiding. And so it actually discourages people from eating fruits and vegetables. So while, you know, there may be a goal of, you know, making our food safer, the result is just most people are less healthy.
Yeah, I mean, we've discussed this before a little bit because I have a master's in nutrition, and I think the sort of prevailing wisdom from people that I'm around is that for sure, like, yeah, what you're saying is definitely true. Like, yes, pesticides could potentially pose some harm and we should investigate that. But when you're giving like a broad message to like the general public, it can actually do more harm than good to focus on those little things that are not perfect. Yeah.
Well, in many households that have limited food budgets or on fixed food budgets, you know, when they choose to buy the organic milk that costs, you know, $2 extra a gallon, what they're ultimately doing is having $2 less for other nutritious food. And so, you know, there's a trade-off whenever somebody is on a fixed food budget when they're making these decisions. And the reality is they should feel, you know, pretty good about the food that's available to them.
That's a bit of a hot take compared to, I think, what we usually see on this program alone. And it's certainly not inaccurate, but I think it points to the fact that somehow we've come to the conclusion as a systemic entity or as a country or a Western world that higher quality food should be more expensive, which is simply ridiculous. I mean, we've essentially made it so that the most vulnerable people who need the best food can't get it because it's more expensive. So that's another whole set of problems. There's another issue that I think has become a buried lead in this last issue, which is we're letting massive corporations set the tone and set the stage for what gets to be sold when, where, and how. And that's one of the real problems with anything, going back to the pesticide argument, going back to what's organic and what's not. We've abdicated our ability to even make those choices as consumers because we're letting massive companies do it for us. So I would hope people actually understand the pesticide issue has much more to do with environmental degradation, with seed patenting, with the ability of farmers to actually own and maintain and manage their own crops. That's much more of an issue, but how are they going to reflect that when they go and buy an apple, when they go and think about eating a piece of celery? They probably won't think about it, is the problem.
Well, I guess I'd push back a little bit on that, because when I look around and I see, you know, who's driving the agenda for what foods we eat, I think it has almost nothing to do with big food. And I think it has a lot to do with startups and other companies, because, you know, big food consumers don't really trust the big companies the way they did 20 or 30 years ago, the big brands. And if consumers are going to try something new, they want to know that they trust the company that's selling it to them. And by and large, that means that they want to know that the founders of those companies share their values. And, you know, that tends to be smaller companies. You know, if you look at just, you know, the rise of oat milk, well, Quaker Oats came out with oat milk a year before Oatly came on to the scene, and the product completely failed. And in January, they pulled it from the market. And that's because, you know, people who are early adopters, the people who try new stuff, do not want to try new stuff from Quaker Oats. They were perfectly happy to buy it from Oatly, but they had absolutely no interest in buying it from a Quaker Oats. And so that's part of the challenge for these big food brands, is that they can only be followers. You know, if they had come out with, you know, Quaker oat milk after Oatly, well, then they could have targeted all of those late adopters, you know, who weren't willing to try this odd sounding, you know, startup Oatly, but were perfectly happy to try oat milk from Quaker Oats after it had already been introduced to the market. So I don't see them as having nearly as much sway as they did, you know, perhaps in the 90s and the early 2000s.
Culturally speaking, that's an excellent point. Go ahead, Emily.
I just think that that's a really interesting point. Correct me if I'm wrong, but basically what you're saying is, because of the increased distrust of major food companies by the consumers, that actually makes them have less sway in consumer choice.
Very little. So, yeah. I mean, think about, you know, just as a thought experiment, imagine for a moment that Monsanto had created the Impossible Burger. I suspect it would not have succeeded, but everybody would have said that it didn't succeed because nobody wants to buy a GMO burger. Well, that obviously isn't actually true. The real tension would have been that it was a large multinational trying to sell it to me, but people would have misunderstood what was actually happening. And because they don't understand that pushback against big food, that's part of the reason why when Impossible Foods went into 18,000 Burger Kings, people started pushing back on the product, which, you know, was a bit of a surprise to Impossible Foods, but it shouldn't have been, because when they went into Burger King, they turned their, you know, sort of niche startup company into a commodity. And those rich people who could go into high-end restaurants and buy it for 20 bucks a burger and then tell all their friends about it, well, now all the poor people down at Burger King could afford it, and all of a sudden it wasn't hip and cool anymore, and so people started pushing back. Well, it was ultra-processed when it was $20 a burger too, but nobody cared.
Yeah, I mean, we're guilty of being early adopters there, but more because we wanted to see that mission succeed than we wanted to brag to our friends. I mean, the whole point was we early on heard that exact debate from some of the smartest people that we knew and spoke to, which was, if this is able to come at $4 to a fast food restaurant, then it has actually succeeded. That's the marker.
Right. But, you know, the people that are driving the trends, you know, sometimes don't like it when things become commoditized. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. when organic, you know, when Bezos said that, you know, he was going to make organic food cheap. Well, I don't know anybody who wants cheap food. You know, what he really meant is he meant it was going to be accessible. But, you know, if you look at the growth in the organic market since 2017, you know, it stopped growing at over 10% and it started growing at less than that. And so once something becomes a commodity, it doesn't mean it doesn't continue to grow, but it does mean it doesn't have that same cachet in the minds of consumers.
And certainly, and that's a product of something achieving some sort of scale. Obviously, nothing yep. can grow massively forever. I mean, something says oat milk sales are up 700% this year. Well, you can't grow 700% annually, right?
Well, and that's what a lot of the people are missing, you know, when it comes to these plant-based foods, because, you know, nobody needs 10 different plant-based burger options when they go to the grocery store. And, you know, many of them are just not going to succeed. And, you know, there's this feeling that if you can make plant-based burgers cheaper than hamburger, that somehow you'll drive hamburger off the market. Well, that means you don't understand economics and you don't understand consumer psychology. Because as soon as plant-based burgers become cheaper than beef, beef becomes the premium product. And so they're just going to change how it's perceived, you know, and then all of a sudden people are going to be like, well, plant-based burgers may taste great, but they're only for poor people. And so that psychology, can undermine its potential future growth. Now, it's still going to grow, but when you think of the economics of it, well, it doesn't matter how much plant-based burgers, hamburgers people consume. Hamburger is a byproduct of steaks. So unless you're, replacing the steak, all you can do is make traditional hamburger cheaper. You can't make it disappear.
Ooh, I think there's a lot to unpack there, and it's certainly not wrong to say that the mindset would shift if you made something cheaper, but I'm no stranger to the interview process. I don't know if it was Spurlock or not, Morgan Spurlock from Supersize Me, who was doing these interviews and collecting this data, but he was sampling between 2010 and 2018 or so, a lot of people all over the country and perception across different fast food restaurants and different stores. And he was asking people if plant-based burgers were cheaper, or if so-and-so, I think he made up a name for a burger or something, and if a fast food restaurant served this cheaper option, but it still tasted the same, he queried people and said, would you still buy this? And they were like, absolutely. If it was a dollar cheaper, 100% of them would buy the cheaper option. So when you talk about the consumption of something at scale, again, people are going to purchase whatever they can afford.
Well, yeah, but how you position it has a lot to do with its success. And sure, right now, by positioning it as cheap, you're positioning it as cheap food, and that undermines the perception of quality. See, yeah. When I was involved in the US-EU trade negotiations, the US kept saying, well, if we can do this trade deal, food will get cheaper, and nobody wants cheap food. So what I kept trying to remind them was to say, if we can do this deal, we'll have quality food at affordable prices. Well, that's what people want. They want quality food at affordable prices. But when the language that we use is so important. And right now you see a lot of the proponents of plant-based foods, highlighting the wet markets in China, and that suggests that, that's another reason for food safety that we need to stop doing. Well, again, they're using this cognitive dissonance to try to drive people away from animal products, and most people just like animal products. Cognitive dissonance, either you agree and you switch, or you become an opponent and it creates reactance and people go out there and buy a double quarter pounder just to stick it in your face. So, we need to change some of that dynamic and that tension, because we need to double the amount of protein by 2050. So there's room for everybody to succeed here. And yet, if we end up, fighting with each other, the livestock people are going to undermine our interest in plant-based foods because of sodium and all these chemicals and other things. And the plant-based people are going to undermine our, confidence in the livestock. And yet, there's room for them both to succeed, or we can just undermine everybody.
Yeah. I mean, I would definitely agree with that. I totally think that there are multiple ways that we can approach the future of food, and we're probably going to approach them multiple ways anyway. So yep, we might as well come together and realize that there are multiple approaches that, changing the way that we do agriculture to make it more sustainable and creating plant-based meats. I mean, both of those things are good options.
Yeah, that's actually something that I got out of the last major documentary I watched on cell-cultured meat, which was that people were going into this, and people, smart journalists, were kept interviewing these owners of early-stage cell-cultured meat companies and saying, do you think you're going to fully replace the existing meat industry? And they're like, stop what you're asking me right now. They said, literally, we can completely succeed if we take 0% of their market share, because there are going to be more people that need to eat food. That's the wrong question.
Yep. Well, and I spent a lot of time working with the cell-based meat companies on some of those specific issues. I don't know if you have followed sort of the conversation around the term clean meat, but I spent a year of my life killing that term among those companies. And the reason was that, if you asked, people at the Good Food Institute and others, why they thought it was good, they'd say, well, it polls really well with consumers, and we feel like it's a little bit like clean energy, and our food, may ultimately be safer. But I don't know any company that wants to go and have a conversation with a journalist about food safety and ethics.
Yeah.
So, the term itself doesn't lead to good conversations, but then it's also highly offensive to livestock producers. So on one hand, you end up having conversations that you don't want to have. And on the other hand, you create blowback, which ends up having 28 states trying to ban your product when you know you're not even on the market. And so, that kind of tension, on the other hand, you could be partnering with the companies as they were to bring these products to market and highlighting, just what you said, which is that, the market potential for both is critical. If we're trying to save global forests, the number one way of doing that is making sure that people have safe, nutritious food. 80% of deforestation is caused by agriculture. And, you can't build fences high enough to keep hungry people out of the forest, nor should you. But if you keep people fed, they will not go into the forest.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. There's an issue with, again, bearing the lead and with actually somewhat creating tides of unfortunate change people aren't intending simply by naming and changing exactly how someone thinks about an issue. Even it's a great example, and it's true that looking at how we talk about clean meat, how we talk about how people are using various resources, it does seem to actively disenfranchise an entire segment of the industry. You'd never want to disparage an organically farmed, deliciously sustainable local steak, but if you then couldn't call that steak, it would be implied that that steak was dirty.
Yep. Well, and it's interesting that the proponents of cell-based and plant-based and all of these other products, I don't know if you've read the book The Wizard and the Prophet by Charles Mann, but many of the people that are proposing cell-based meat, they're wizards. They're people who believe that science and technology can help us to solve these, great challenges that we face. And yet many of the people out there that, are opposed to large industrial agriculture are completely opposed to what they're doing as well. And so, the allies and relationships and, ways of who you're going to work with is very different. I think people are surprised at, the kinds of relationships that this drives.
Yeah, no, and I've actually, I believe I own the book. Have I read the whole thing? No, but I've certainly had that information close at hand, and I've heard people talking through it and about it and because of it. So it's a good book, and we'll link to it in the show notes.
Well, if you haven't seen it or read it, all you have to do is watch Avengers Infinity War, and it's exactly the same story. Because in that book, you have Thanos, who is the prophet, and he's trying to eliminate half the beings in the universe so that everybody has enough to eat. And, ultimately, it's a question of, is science the solution to our problem or the problem to be solved? And that's sort of the issue at the heart of Avengers Infinity War. And it's also the story at the heart of The Wizard and the Prophet. So if you've seen the movie,
yeah,
you've got it covered.
Yeah, we definitely have.
We'd see that comparison.
But we did see the movie. Yeah. No, but just in general, that concept is really, really a fascinating one.
The book is really just saying that there are two types of people in the world. And,
yeah,
there are those who believe that we need to reduce ourselves out of the problems we face. And there are others who believe that science and technology can help to grow us out of the problems that we face.
Yeah.
And, in the book, the two main characters, Norman Borlaug and William Vogt, sort of represent those two sides of this conversation. And what's important about it is that it doesn't really matter which one you are, though I suspect, people who listen to this podcast tend to be wizards, sort of excited by the science. It doesn't matter. It matters that you know who you're talking to and which one they are, because you need to use the language of the person you're talking to. You can't. Yeah, otherwise you're just speaking to, yourself, or you're speaking to the converted.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. I mean, yeah, honestly, I think we try to be somewhere in between, but that's sort of a hard realm. Like, that there's a lot of good that science and technology can do, but
Well, I think there's a role for both.
Yeah.
It's not, but I think how you approach problems tends to reflect sort of one of those philosophical positions
sure.
or another.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that, you know, many times the people who are the prophets who are concerned that there aren't enough resources point out problems, and then wizards come along and actually do help to solve some of those problems.
Yeah.
You know, and it's going to be a combination of the two. You know, we're going to hopefully reduce our footprint on the planet, and we're going to produce things more sustainably and intensively in places that can afford to do it.
Yeah.
Certainly. I think most people miss the boat there and don't realize that we are actively tackling so many issues at once in so many ways and actively ignoring others in so many ways. The answer is usually we're doing everything, and that's half the problem.
Yeah. Well, and I think conservation organizations haven't done a terribly good job of talking about how far we've come. You know, they always use today as the baseline, and they talk about the impact of agriculture on land and water and climate and deforestation. And all of those problems are real. But if you were to use something like 1980 as our baseline, well, you know, farmers in America producing a bushel of corn have reduced the greenhouse gas emissions by 35% over that from between 1980 and 2011. They have reduced water use by 50%. They've reduced soil erosion on that land by 60%. So they're doing everything wildly better than they were doing it before. Now, that doesn't mean the problems aren't still there and they're still real, because they're producing so much more corn. But if they weren't doing things so much more efficiently, you know, there wouldn't actually be any forest today. So, you know, it would be good if they used 1980 as the baseline, because then it would be clear that things are getting better, but not fast enough, as opposed to things are bad and getting worse. Because if things are bad and getting worse, then farmers are the problem to be solved. If things are good and getting better, then farmers are the solution to our problem. And how you talk about it determines whether or not the entire food and ag value chain is part of the conversation or the bad guy.
Yeah, no, I think that's fascinating. And I think we would definitely both agree that words, really, like how you talk about things, words are really powerful, like especially, right, how you talk about them to consumers, to the media, and to different people with different opinions. And I'm not a fan of the clean meat, going back a little bit. I'm not a friend of the word clean, really, for food. And then cheap, you were saying cheap before, you know, instead of quality. Quality and affordable, right? Yeah, there is just this like connotation, like the connotation to the word really matters.
People kept asking me what I would suggest as an alternative, and I eventually said craft meat, because as soon as I say craft meat, you imagine it's something like craft beer, and you are creating it through fermentation in the same way that you would create these you know, cell-based products. But more important than that, if I were to offer you a craft beer versus, you know, some generic beer, you know, you choose the craft beer even if you didn't know where it was from, because you sort of assume that it has a place associated with it. And when you think about things like cell-based meat, one of the big challenges they have is that you don't associate it with place. And the term clean meat doesn't help with that. But if I said, oh, clean meat or Memphis meat Brooklyn, Memphis meat San Francisco, it's a craft meat, all of a sudden, you know, you expect Memphis meat San Francisco to actually be a different product than Memphis meat Brooklyn, because it has that sense of place.
Whoa, boy. I mean, this is sort of a language theory, and I love this. I think it's so powerful, but the way this stuff operates, it's often very, very challenging to get a consumer to even realize decisions they're making come down to choices in language like this.
Yeah, well, you just slap the word natural on a product and you have a huge impact, not just on, you know, people's willingness to buy. But as soon as I put the word natural on a product, people assume that it has fewer calories, they assume that it's safer, they assume that, you know, all of these other, you know, health halo effects apply to it just from that one word that is undefined by FDA.
Yeah.
Correct.
Do you have any idea why, though, that we as humans are so attracted to the word natural?
Well, you know, there's an article on this on my blog on the naturalness bias.
Yeah,
I just it's wondered. Just one of the things that, you know, we're naturally predisposed or we are disposed towards things that are natural. We have an aversion to things that are man-made.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, all of the bad things in the world are natural too. I think coronavirus being at the top of that list. But we all still think happy thoughts when we hear the word natural. We just can't help it.
Yeah. No, I do. I read the blog, I guess. Yeah, I guess it's more of a philosophical question that is hard to answer, right? Like, evolutionarily, like, is why are we attracted to that? But I guess it, you know, just recognizing that we are and being able to counter that is
Yeah,
more
I mean, it
important.
probably arose more from freshness that, you know, there was a time, you know, back in the 1900s, you know, 1800s rather, when, you know, our food really wasn't safe and natural was associated with fresh, and fresh is the only way you really knew that something wasn't adulterated.
That's a good thought for sure.
I believe it, yeah. And I recently am thinking about watching Morgan Spurlock in another feature film. It was about making his own chicken restaurant. And, or it was like, what the holy
Yeah, I
chicken.
saw a preview for that as well.
It was pretty fascinating, and he busted all of those packaging myths wide open, including natural. He was able to start up and sell factory farmed fried chicken, and call it cage free, natural, from the earth, artisanal grown. He used every possible word that had no legal requirements on it. It was shocking.
No, I'm curious. I'd like to come back to something you said about, I don't know if it was patenting of seeds or control of seeds. I'd be curious to hear you unpack that a little bit.
Certainly. So I was wondering if we'd pull into this, and I think it was almost a dovetail from the conversation we had a couple minutes ago about clean meat, which was the three of us sitting here are some of the best people in the world, or at least in this area, to say the hype and the fear around GMOs by some of the smartest people is the dumbest possible reaction. And that's always really bothered me because they've completely missed the boat to have the right reaction to GMOs, which is, oh, suddenly a couple of multinationals run by people you've never heard of actually control what Joe the farmer is allowed to grow forever and are going to sue him if he doesn't follow the line. And instead, what you have is really, really, really smart people defending some defending GMOs for being not biochemically dangerous, which is true, and other, unfortunately, really smart people attacking GMOs for being biochemically dangerous, which is not true. So they've completely, all of them all together, missed both sides of getting on the boat, which is there's a huge problem now in who actually controls the seeds that are being grown, in what sort of pesticides we are dumping on fields, which do not harm the consumers of the food. They harm everyone else involved, from the farmers to the groundwater supply to the next crop you grow in that field, to the wildlife and the ecology and the ecosystem, which can no longer be sort of holistically situated in a farm or in a agricultural biome, and is now going to be disparate or disjointed in some way because of monocropping. Those issues don't get brought up because they're frankly much more complicated. But it's definitely something we think about almost all the time.
Yeah, I guess I actually see it pretty differently from where you are. And, you know, a lot of that probably has to do with the fact that, you know, I spent a decade trying to ensure that new technologies reached smallholder farmers in Africa and Asia and other places. And, you know, so I come to it, you know, from the other end of the spectrum. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Central Africa and a science teacher in the middle of you know, a small village. And while, you know, I certainly worry about ownership of the food supply, when I look at the United States, you know, I spent a lot of time out there talking to farmers, and I didn't feel like too many farmers felt like they were beholden to the seed companies. I remember the first time I visited a soybean grower in Iowa, this back in probably 2003, And he told me the story about how his father, they planted Roundup Ready soybeans for the first time, and then they were spraying them with the Roundup. And his dad knew what Roundup was because it was a weed killer, and he kept saying to his son, "Are you sure we want to spray this on our field?" And he said, No, it'll be fine." And they did it. And he said, after we sprayed and there was the burn down, he said, "My dad almost cried because he had never seen a field of soybeans that looked so good." And when you look at the labor savings and other things, it really transformed their lives. Now, we're almost 20 years in the future from that, and doesn't mean that there aren't other consequences. But, since the 1940s, farmers have been buying seed every year. If you're a corn farmer, not soybeans traditionally. But, nothing has really changed in corn. If it's a hybrid, you have to buy it every year. If it's a GMO hybrid, you have to buy it every year. We still don't have GMO wheat, so people are often saving their seeds in wheat. But I've met with lots of wheat growers, and they're begging companies to bring more technology to the wheat market. I know that those are potential concerns, but I guess I haven't seen it as much in the field. And it's not as if companies can sue farmers because pollen drifts from one field to another. The only people that are getting sued are people that are intentionally saving their seed from one season to the next. And and to that extent, they're cheating their neighbors, and generally it's the neighbors that are sort of providing information to the companies about it happening. Anyway, that's my perspective from where I was, and I was in the government and had a obviously a particular take on things.
Sure, and as is the situation in most of these conversations, it's always more complicated than even two parties can discuss. And the headline, "Oh, both of these contrary opinions are correct," never seems to make it into any sort of journalistic publication because there's so much more interested in saying this side won the argument. And the reality is that GMOs have saved millions of lives and poisoned thousands of others.
Well, I'm not sure that they poisoned anybody. I mean, I think, maybe if we're talking about, some of the, I mean, Roundup is, far safer than most of the herbicides that were used before. Now, if we're talking about, dicamba or something like that, things have certainly changed. But I mean, before that, even if you were to read reports from the Organic Trade Association, most of them would have said, if we got rid of Roundup, we would only go back to more, dangerous chemicals.
Yeah. No, I'm really glad you guys are discussing this because Noah and I talk about this a lot, and I think this is fascinating to have sort of two sides of this argument. I feel like I'm in the middle on a lot of this, but it's really interesting to me.
Right. Careful. Again, don't always assume an argument has only two sides either.
Right.
Well, no, I'm
Well,
not.
Careful.
and I'm also a huge proponent of organic agriculture. So, so don't get me wrong. I've actually, this is one area where I've sort of changed my perspective. When I started out, I was very concerned about making sure that people in the poorest parts of the world had access to food, and growing food organically just meant you were going to have 10 or 15% more land that was needed, and so that just didn't seem wise to me. But over time, what I came to realize is that in many ways, organic is a test bed for new ideas. And they solve problems in ways that no conventional or industrial farmer ever would. And so, we probably wouldn't have low-till and no-till agriculture as sort of the norm if some organic farmer had not believed in her heart it was the right thing to do. And we probably wouldn't be using cover crops if it wasn't for the organic farmers who believed in their hearts it was the right thing to do, and big data came along and proved them right. So for me, the diversity of our food system is the strength of our food system.
That's very, very well
That
said.
is, I think, to me, uncontroversially a good idea. Yeah, diversity
Yeah.
is a strength in almost any supply side issue.
That's interesting that, you've worked in, developing countries and we're in the Peace Corps and things, because that I sort of ran into that ethical debate when I was working with a professor, doing basically like genetically modifying crops to both increase their like nutritional value and make them more resistant to like abiotic stressors, which like when the climate is changing, that's important. So That's a really interesting example, I think, that I personally came across, where I think, yeah, in many studies, you find that farmers actually in these countries see ag tech and see those kind of innovations in a very positive light. And it's kind of about like where you're coming from, which I think goes back to your idea of like as our food supply gets better, then we look for like more and more like little things that are wrong with it. But like if you're in a developing country, right, and you don't have access to quality food on a regular basis, like you're more likely to perceive those like agricultural innovations as actually positive if they benefit you on a more personal level and improve your food security.
Yeah, absolutely. In the same way that, smartphones allowed, many people in Africa to leapfrog completely over landlines and things that, many of us grew up with, there's this opportunity for them to skip over some of the negative consequences of the Green Revolution and to move on to technologies that, are more appropriate to where they are without having to, move to the large scale, agriculture, that we have in the United States and other places, because many of these, insect resistant crops are even more beneficial to small farmers than they are to large. They seem because if you're a large farmer in the United States, you're either spraying an insecticide or you're using insect resistant crops, but you're controlling the insects either way. But, in South Africa, when they started using insect resistant corn or cotton, they had control for the very first time. So their yields, just exploded. So it was really life-changing.
Right. And I mean, that's something about the Green Revolution just in general, right? I think a lot of people now criticize the Green Revolution for increasing our reliance on synthetic fertilizers and pesticides, and I do think it did that, but I think it was solving a problem at the time, right? Like kind of like you said, in the 80s, where we were trying to like feed more people. And so it's kind of, I don't know, I just feel like in society, we just sort of like create problems, solve problems, and then create new problems and solve new problems. You know what I mean? We were actually trying to solve a major problem with the Green Revolution, but yeah, we did create some problems with that too, you know?
Well, but you can, back then, 1969, the population bomb came out and, predicted that 1 billion people were going to die because of, hunger in India, Pakistan, and Africa. And of course, the Green Revolution ensured that 1 billion people didn't die. And I think that's definitely in the plus column,
For
saving a
sure.
billion people. But also this challenge of population, it's not something that we're going to have to deal with forever. People are worried about population growth, but in the next 30 or 40 years, we're probably going to reach the peak, and population could start coming down. At the very least, we're not having more kids. The number of kids born this year will be the same or less or more than the number of kids born the year next year and the year after. So we've already reached probably peak child, and the only reason that population is increasing is because of people living longer. So 100% of population growth is a good news story of people living longer, but they're not going to live forever. So, the challenge that we have is not to keep feeding more and more people forever and population keeps growing. It's really just the next 30 or 40 years, because then population starts to plateau. And every year after 2050, it gets easier to feed people because they're not increasing the number as quickly. So the challenge for us is to get to 2050 without cutting down our forests and without draining our rivers, our lakes, and our aquifers, because if we do, we are good forever. So I like to tell people that the next 30 years are not just the most important 30 years there have ever been in the history of agriculture, and they are, they're the most important 30 years there will ever be in the history of agriculture. And that's why we got to get it right.
Yeah, I mean
Couldn't agree
it's hard
more.
to it's hard to it's hard to say for sure, but yeah, I mean so far I think.
Well, if you look at the UN population estimates, how many people do you think will be on the planet in the year 2300, based on current projections?
I don't
I give you the answer: 3.5 billion people. So we're
know.
going to have half as many people,
Okay.
in just, a couple hundred years. And I know that seems like a long time, but that's a lot fewer people than, you know, we're feeding today. And assuming productivity and all these things continue to get better, that means even by the year 2100, we could either take all of South America out of production and grow every, or grow everything organically. You know, we're going to have options just in the next 80 years that we just don't have today.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, these are the large existential questions that very, very few people even think about, but we as futurists have been thinking about for decades, right? And I wish there was more of that foresight that was being applied, because it just seems like everyone thinks about things in the context of it having been this way forever, and it's going to be this way forever after now, which is just profoundly ignorant to think about almost any issue that way.
Well, just projecting each trend, you know, is, out. It's unfortunate because, you know, what's interesting about this moment is that for 10,000 years of agriculture, we've just been asking farmers to produce more food. Mm-hmm. And we're at that one moment in history where we need them to stop producing just more food and produce better food.
Better food.
And so rather than sort of blame people, the farmers, for obesity and the food companies, they succeeded in mission one. Now we need their help with mission two.
Right. That's how I see the Green Revolution. It definitely helped, but we just have a new problem. We just have a new problem to solve that people couldn't even necessarily foresee back then.
Certainly, and that's what founds my fear in a very small number of truly massive companies making all of those decisions for the rest of us, because they're going to care about their bottom line in the next fiscal quarter, not 30 years from now. They are required by law for their shareholders to care about their bottom line, and that decision making shows a lack of foresight, which is really not good for many people, not good for our planet.
Yeah, I guess I don't see it as as negative as that. I feel
he's
like
there's been
remarkable change, you know, in how our food is produced and interest in it, and you know, social programs and other things. That if you look at the World Resources Institute and, you know, their predictions sort of what we would need to do in order to have the right food system in 2050, 70% of what needs to be done is already baked into their assessment based on the trajectory that we're already on. And, you know, that to me, you know, it's amazing that we could sort of count on 70% there as with business as usual. And I know that there are, you know, bad players out there. There are companies that are not thinking as long term as they should. But the companies that don't think long term won't be here for the long term.
I certainly hope that's true, and that's a very wise perspective to have on it. But I think we've seen a lot of companies that shouldn't survive continue to survive based on the financial plays they're making, not the environmental plays they're making. So yeah, that's excellent. And I think we're about to see some of those changes come to the automotive industry, hopefully, where old companies we thought were established are going to really suffer if they don't make the change to electric vehicles. But it's absolutely always an open landscape and a willing environment for companies that do have any sort of forethought to survive, and those that don't to fall off. But with the amount of money that some are banking away, they can keep making poor decisions. And as long as there are resources to consume, it's not going to hurt them directly. We have to have some sort of pushback on companies that are actively harming the planet, society as a whole. If we don't do that, they're going to continue to be the ones making the decisions and just buying up all the competitors who could do better.
Yeah, well, I think that's where transparency is important. You know, we need to shine a light on companies that are bad actors, and, you know, more and more, that's all you need to do in order to change their opinion. You don't need to change policies if you change the opinion of the shareholder.
Certainly. Yeah. That activity can all occur. I mean, we've seen, again, Tesla do its disruption very, very effectively. We can get other car companies. I think, what was it, VW really saw the writing on the wall, and now you hear basically environmentalism from their CEO, which is fantastic. And you didn't hear that 10 years ago. Being sued for diesel emissions 10 years ago. So it's definitely something that can change, but that may not in every case. And so it worries me when we see many traditional companies not taking new and bolder stances to do anything better because they don't feel forced to yet. Let's force them.
I think that we're starting to get to a point where companies do feel forced by consumer pressure. I think we're getting to a point. Maybe we're not where you want us to be now, but I think we're getting to a point where people are starting to value sustainability as in part of business models.
I think that there's a danger in blaming the companies when companies historically probably would have said, consumers may say that they want free-range chicken or cage-free eggs and other things, and we produce them and then they don't buy them. And right. So, I'm not sure that I see most of these companies as immoral. I see a lot of them as amoral. they would sell us, be perfectly happy to sell us, super healthy food if we would buy it. And they're perfectly happy to sell us super processed food that's not healthy because we buy it. The companies come out with thousands of new products every year, and it's the market that decides which ones they keep selling. I hope that they will become more of a partner in helping us to be healthier than just giving us, what we ask for, give us what we need. But to me, that's asking a lot of them, to sort of challenge their bottom line by promoting products that consumers aren't obviously asking for.
So there's, once again, a whole bunch to unpack here. And this comes from my history of being a student of media and culture, something I studied in college as well. One of the biggest issues, what you just said was incredibly wise, but there's a subtle, pernicious problem in the entire formulation of that sort of trade-off, of that system of knowledge exchange, because the perfectly correct statement you're making that consumer behavior influences what a company produces and sells runs in direct contrast with a separate and parallel reality, which is the same companies doing that production, producing things to sell when it comes to food, cars, music, television, whatever it is, those same companies also are the ones creating the very media and culture which then control consumer psychology. And I say control in the lightest possible sense, control in the most generic sense of this is what is displayed, therefore it is what is consumed. So the same players that run the advertising run the food production. The same companies that produce the meat run the healthcare organization. There's a lot more interplay and overlap, which actually produces less organic or less intrinsic consumer choice than the average consumer thinks they actually have.
Yeah, I think companies are just terrible at what you're saying they're doing. And when I look around, I believe the consumer should be eating a lot more, fruits and vegetables in particular. And when big food tries to address that problem, 90% of people aren't getting the, fruits and vegetables they need. And so Kraft comes out with vegetable frosting, which is ranch dressing. So they're taking the least nutritious dressing and giving it to kids, and their marketing campaign is lie like a parent. So, if that's the kind of, marketing that we have to worry about, I think they're doomed. And so I just think that consumers today are more savvy, and they're looking for things that, they would like things that are a little bit deeper and, actually have those health benefits. Now, a lot of the problems I see today are coming from smaller companies who are able to sort of get away with marketing that no large company would ever claim in terms of, the functional aspects of food. It's the Wild West when it comes to small companies these days, not to the large ones. But I'm hopeful that consumers do want more healthy food. So the desire for it at least gives me some hope.
Sure, and I think that's totally fair to claim, and that I'd be inspired and encouraged to believe that there is enough pushback and there is enough light in the darkness that they can make these choices despite there being a huge wealth of advertising to the contrary. Now, it's disingenuous to say that people make decisions in a vacuum, but this gets sort of unfortunately deeply philosophical, because it's really important when it comes to consumer psychology, which is that what we think and want is a composite of things that we've been told. And what I mean by that is, knowledge doesn't come to us in a vacuum. So what you think and believe is the most organic, heartfelt, emotionally deep and pure private thought you ever had probably came to you because someone taught you how to have that thought. Maybe not directly, maybe not in the way you're thinking, but we receive so much influence from forces around us that it's really impossible to say we're not getting deep, deep messaging from companies that stand to benefit financially from that messaging. And the worst part of it is it's hard to trace. So it may just be that some billionaire CEO who has an interest in a food company has his music company insert a lyric somewhere in a song at one point, which then gets played up by a journalist who works for another huge company whose CEO himself has another interest in that food company to the seventh degree of separation. I mean, that could be what's happening. And because culture is so influential to all people all the time everywhere, that still happens. We still get that downplayed, down-level base influence we were trying to avoid in the first place, or that the food company didn't actually know to advertise or wasn't powerful enough to themselves advertise. You're right, they're not always good at it, and that's certainly true. It can be a yes and, it can be a yes both. It can be a situation where people don't understand really how a message comes to them in the end, but it still does.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I completely agree. And, you know, the entire blog series that I'm working on now is devoted 100% to these hidden influences and helping consumers to understand how the words are influencing them, you know, every single day, how your mindset influences you when you go to the grocery store. You know, what is decision fatigue? You know, why is it so much harder for low-income people to shop responsibly than, you know, somebody who doesn't have to worry about, you know, buying the most expensive nutritious product? And so I completely agree with you, but I look at the arc of history, and, you know, I think that when you look at, you know, the 1960s, you know, the future of food was a TV dinner, and ultra processed foods, you know, were exciting. And, you know, we've come a long way, you know, from having two choices of tomato sauce in our grocery store, Prego and Ragu, in 1980, to having dozens of different varieties today. The produce options in our grocery stores are just, you know, amazing compared to where they were. So I think we're still at the beginning of figuring out how do we get people to eat the right mix. And I'm not sure I blame the companies for it, because, you know, consumers have been buying larger dinner plates, you know, just because they look good and fashionable, but they've also been, you know, huge increases in, you know, consumption. Mm-hmm. You know, people keep going back to the restaurants that give you bigger serving sizes and larger, you know, larger portions. And, you know, the cost of food is not the most expensive part of, you know, a restaurant. And so, you know, it's really labor and real estate. And so, you know, expecting them to not give you food when the next restaurant over is, and it's not even a cost factor, it's just not very likely to happen unless we can change the mindset, right? So if you think, you know, eating twice as much as you want is not good value, getting two meals, if you take one of them home, is amazing value. And, you know, that's where, you know, my interest is with, you know, consumer behavior, and how do we reshape our conversation so that we get people to make decisions that, you know, work for them without forcing them to do things. We just reshape our environment. And, you know, one example of this that I've been proposing was, instead of arguing for things like soda taxes, where you're trying to force the behavior that you want, and people who drink soda hate it, people who sell soda hate it, why not do something like encouraging restaurants that serve, that offer free refills, to give a 12-ounce cup as the default? Now, that doesn't seem like a big deal. You know, they're free refills, so what would it matter if you give them a 12-ounce cup? But Subway, largest restaurant chain in the world with 40,000 locations, gives you a 21-ounce cup. So if we could convince every Subway in the world to give people a 12-ounce cup, we would reduce 1 billion calories of soda consumption every single day with no policy intervention. Nobody would be upset, and every restaurant would make more money. That, to me, is a difference between sort of a policy prescription versus, you know, working with consumer psychology.
Sure, and it's carrot versus stick a bit, and it's the idea of changing a base level play, and I think Europe is even greater at that. They have smaller portions and always have, but one of the key points there is, yes, if we can change the base level behavior, that will ripple out and have much larger effects anyways. Incentives always work that way, and the problem is essentially that really, really changing those base level behaviors is far more challenging than a lot of people realize or are willing to start doing, and really thinking about those even being changeable, right? So we have to get to a point where we teach that as being a changeable, a growable, an encourageable factor that we could actually manipulate in a positive way. Once we can do that, we can do anything.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea. I mean, yeah, I'm generally a fan of all sort of solutions that help consumers eat better without realizing that they are, you know, and that's basically what the cup thing would do. I think, yeah, the soda tax thing arguably does that a little bit, but right, not in the same way, right? I think that the consumer approach is probably actually more effective. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, and with soda taxes, we know we can shift behavior a little bit, but, you know, we haven't really demonstrated that we can improve nutritional outcomes. And so unless you can actually tie the change in behavior to a nutrition outcome, you don't actually know if you've achieved anything. You do know that it's a regressive tax that, you know, takes money out of the pockets of low-income people. And so there's some challenges with that. But, you know, when I think about food, nobody gained 30 pounds or 50 pounds in a year. They gained 1 or 2 or 3 pounds a year for the last 30 years.
Right.
And so, you know, it's because our food environment, our foodscape has changed, and it's that food the architecture of our lives. If we could change that, then maybe we could get people to lose 1 or 2 or 3 pounds a year. So it's not going to be dramatic, but they're not going to have to change anything. You know, they're just going to go about their lives. You know, nobody in 1960 knew anything about nutrition, but they were somehow in better shape than we are today.
That's the big question, right? That's the big distrust in nutrition, you know, being sort of a nutrition scientist. There's sort of that distrust there because of that.
When people are asking for fixes, and, you know, that's just not the way nutrition works.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
Right. People always want a silver bullet, and of course there really isn't one.
Well, the reason, so again, philosophically, culturally, speaking about the communication theory behind that, people want a silver bullet because it's a tangible way to solve a problem that has no tangible solution, right? So we really crave A plus B equals C type of answers. We really want things, or 2 plus 2 equals 4, rather, that's even more clear. We want things that have some sort of sense of linearity to them. And as soon as ideas get more networked and more complicated, people are much less likely to understand and then respect the convolutions therein. So it becomes ever more challenging to get someone to make a choice if that choice is nonlinear. So if you present someone an option to eat something and the choice is either do this or don't do this, well, that makes a lot of sense. But if the choice is, okay, you can't do this, but you must now do one of these 20 things, you've created a situation where the person is more likely to rebel against having to make the choice than to change.
Yeah, well, that gets into decision fatigue and other issues. So, yeah, couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an issue that, again, we have to solve these issues as a society, but an individual person will find much more of a challenge. This makes me think of, again, multiple movies here, that line from Men in Black, where a person is smart, people are dumb, panicky animals. You have to think about is the decision-making process that goes on, and if you're catering to a mass audience, you're only ever going to be able to provide, produce, and promulgate and really spread out a solution that is the simplest possible answer to a problem, whereas at an individual level, people are much more able to make a complex decision.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because on one level, you know, we have the wisdom of the crowd, you know, some many decisions groups are better at coming up to it with a solution than others. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when it comes to food, you know, that's obviously not the case, that, you know, they move from one fad diet to another fad diet and nobody really believes the next one's going to work. But since all of their friends are doing it, and, you know, why not jump on board?
Yeah. So I really have enjoyed this conversation a lot. I don't know if you want to sort of just give your thoughts on how, before we go, sort of how like the food supply chain is sort of being affected in consumer behavior by the current coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, I think that you know, there's a lot going on, and what I'm worried about is, you know, the long-term impact on nutritional health. Right now, we're seeing a lot of people that there's this return to basic and staple foods, probably greater trust of large food brands than there has been for a while, because, you know, those are the things that we know. And but I think over time, it's going to have an impact on, you know, whether or not people are willing to try new food technologies. I think there will be an interest in functional foods. But for a while, you know, people are going to come out of this with a lot less income and a lot less ability to try new stuff. Right. And so I think there's going to be a narrowing of the, you know, the food options that are out there. Many of the food venture funds and others are probably going to pull back a little bit because it's not going to be a good time to invest. You know, we're going to change the dynamics of an entire generation. I think for people like us, you know, we may return to normal. But for many people, you know, this is going to have a lasting impact, you know, in many ways, like the Great Depression, because, you know, many people are already, you know, their paychecks have run out and, you know, they don't have a lot of money in the bank. And so for the next couple of weeks, if not the next few months, things are going to be incredibly tight. And so I think it's going to leave it. And then we're going to be in a recession after all of this is over. So, I guess I would just, you know, comment that we still don't know the scale or the magnitude of this current crisis on the next generation. And, you know, it'll be a little while before we really can get our hands around that. So that's sort of what I'm watching these days.
Yeah, right, of course. That was a big question there. What is your thoughts on food and coronavirus?
Anyone who watches long-term trends and you see within a couple of weeks the largest economic stimulus in the history of the planet being delivered almost without debate, you realize things have gotten very serious.
Well, and then you look at, you know, just in the last week, what's happening with meat processing plants, you know, one after another, they're shutting down. And in 2019, one facility, there was a fire at a Tyson facility, shut down 5% of the production of beef in the United States, and that led to higher food prices on the shelves. You know, what's going to happen when it's not 5%, but it's 10% or 15 or 20? And the repercussions are greater, because what happens is that you end up with really high food prices for consumers, but there's no capacity for livestock producers, so they actually are getting paid less. So you have this disconnect where on one hand it's super expensive at the grocery store and you can't make money by selling livestock. So, you know, a rational rancher is going to produce less, you know, based on those market signals. And so that means that even when we come out of this crisis, all of a sudden people haven't created the production capacity because they didn't know if there was going to be a market for it. So, you know, those are the kinds of secondary and tertiary repercussions that, you know, I think are just beginning to come into focus.
That's, I mean, that's an excellent perspective. And once again, the challenge of nonlinear thinking here, how do we think, what does the future look like? How do we plan for unanticipated shrinking, growing, et cetera, that's always what people are pretty bad at. But we need to think about how to achieve that and how to think more broad scale and think more long term, or we're going to run into situations like this all the time. The just-in-time supply chain is really vulnerable to situations like this.
Yeah, I think it's going to force a return to inventory. But it's also accelerating other trends. So that it's reversing a trend like that, but it could be accelerating a trend like online purchases. Before coronavirus, only about 5% of consumers were buying, each month food online. And I think in March, the number was about a third of Americans had bought some food online, and nearly 50% of those were doing it for the very first time. And so, getting people to purchase something online for the first time is just this enormous, psychological obstacle to overcome. And so if we come out of this with, 70, 80, 90% of consumers comfortable shopping for food online, that's going to be dramatic. And when you think about who were the winners, well, 60% of that online purchase of food went to Walmart. So, and then Amazon was about 15% after that. And so, some really interesting dynamics coming out of this.
Yikes.
I think it can, right, make people more, I don't know, be more comfortable with like existing larger brands, but for sure. Yeah, the startup landscape is definitely probably going to take a hit. The other thing it could potentially do, though, which is something I think about, is maybe encouraging people to cook at home more because they don't have access to all these restaurants. So it's an interesting other trend that could potentially be good, increase sort of self-reliance.
And so that's where I see this, it's not about acceleration versus disruption. It's about acceleration versus reversal. And so when it, the trend had been to eating more and more at restaurants, this changes that and actually moves it backwards. We used to get milk, delivered to our home, and now we're getting it again. We used to prepare food at our home, and we're doing it again. And so, it's not just, so there's this opportunity to really change what the our relationship to food looks like coming out of this.
That's a really brilliant way to look at it, and it's somewhat encouraging, I would think, a silver lining if there is one to be found here. Really quickly though, I also am just sort of curious because we kept touching on this a little bit, but speaking about the future of food, what's virus perhaps notwithstanding here, what's something that a typical consumer, a person just trying to get by, a person trying to buy what's best for them and their family, whatever the situation may be, whether they devote a lot of time and energy to their food or not, what are some of the choices that people should be looking out to make positively? What are things they should be looking for companies to do positively, that would really make the tomorrow of their food situation, of their food landscape brighter and better?
Well, I think it goes back to the point about, cooking at home. Many people, especially lower income, were working two or three jobs, and the thought of trying to cook at home, just was unrealistic. And so it was often, cheaper to buy fast food. But now, if you do have time, you don't necessarily have to buy highly processed foods. You can actually cook more whole foods, and it tends to actually be, cheaper than buying a ready meal, prepared meal. So I think that, helping people, give them the tools to do a better job of doing that. Obviously money is going to be tight, but if you're, instead of buying a prepared meal, or buying something takeout from a restaurant, you're preparing it, then there should be room for that. My family, we ordered the very first pizza we have ever ordered at my house in the last 3 years. And I think it was $30 for a large pizza with some other stuff. And I couldn't help but think, my God, for $30 we could have had, this amazing meal. And my kids were happy because, they just hadn't ordered pizza forever, so it was an amazing meal for them. But so I just think that there is some room for people to change, you know, what it is they're buying. And I think, you know, companies should be taking note of this coming out of it, and what are the opportunities for them to reset their relationship with the consumer.
Turn it off and turn it back on again. The whole system, everything.
It's been really great talking to you. Do you want to sort of tell us where we can find your website? And I know you have a YouTube video.
Yes, so you can find me at futuritifood.com. Futurity sounds like a made-up word, but it's not. And you can also watch one of my TEDx talks on why we fear the food we eat. And hopefully some people will check out some of the blog posts that I have on my website as well.
Great. And thank you so much for your time. We really appreciated having you.
It's been fun.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jack. It's quite a treat to talk to someone with this level of knowledge in the field.
Well, I look forward to keeping in touch.
Thanks so much for listening. This has been Evolution Eats.